This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. And today we are going to look back on the Main Street career of Doug Hamilton. Doug died Friday, August 5th at age 72 from complications of acute myeloid leukemia. Doug first joined the Prairie Public family in 2012, stepping in as host of what was then Hear It Now, currently this show, Main Street. Following decades of work in TV and radio, in both commercial and public news, and even a stint in higher education, working at Minnesota State University Moorhead. He was active in theater, going all the way back to the 1960s. We received a number of comments from our listeners. Michelle calls him a rare gem. Denise found him to be warm, extremely talented, and a great supporter of community. Wayne found him to be wickedly funny, very smart, impishly playful, and very creative. A memorial service is set for 11 a.m. on Friday, August 26th, at the Delmar J. Hansen Theater at Minnesota State University, Moorhead. On that day, August 26th, on Main Street, we will be airing a tribute to Doug. But we are going to start today with a remembrance from his friend and acting colleague, Executive Director of Theater B, Carrie Winterstein.
Clearly, Doug was really well known. But one thing that people may not know about Doug is that he maintained his membership in the Union of Professional Actors, the Actors Equity Association, despite there being no union theater in the Fargo-Moorhead area. And as a man of integrity, he abided by the policy of the union, and he never worked for free and hoped that the union wouldn't notice. He worked under contract and respected the union policies. And in doing so, I think he set a standard in this market, helped remind us that actors are skilled, trained workers who should be paid for their work unless they're choosing to donate it, which he did quite a lot for various causes, but always within the policy of the Actors Union. Fortunately, we could, at Theater B, negotiate with him what was called a special appearance contract. And it would allow him to perform with us in some really beautiful roles. But we could only contract him for so many weeks in a year. So it was indeed a very special appearance when he was on our stage. Doug lit up our tiny stage with his larger-than-life presence and that rich, warm voice. And he was a consummate professional, always arriving early to rehearsal, fully prepared, focused, and, unlike so many of the rest of us, completely memorized. He was generous on stage, reliable, bold in his choices, confident and yet gracious, his ego invisible. It was a joy to work with him. I had the pleasure of playing Doug's wife 3 times over the last 10 or so years, and it was such a gift in my life. Such a gift as an actor to come to the stage and come to the rehearsal, always knowing Doug was going to be there, completely stalwart and reliable, and also connected. We first had Doug on our stage playing Mr. Lockhart in The Seafarer back in 2010. And one of my favorite things about that show was not just that he was such an anchor for it, but that afterward, a complete stranger came up to me and said, "I just saw this show at the Guthrie last year, and this production was better." I think that's because Doug was our anchor. I got to play his wife as Titania in A Midsummer Night's Dream when he played Oberon for us in 2011. And then he did our staged reading of Eight, the play, at the Fargo Theater, the play that explored the California decision around marriage equality. He then played my husband Michael in God of Carnage in 2013. He anchored our strange season in the Broadway Theater Garage, the tire bay of the Goodyear Tire Store that is now no longer on Broadway and 4th. We did three shows in that space that season, and Doug, of course, again, anchored a show called How the World Began at the beginning of that strange little season. And then we actually kind of built a season around him a bit. In 2019-20, Doug was actually an anchor at both ends of that season, bookending our season with Hamlet at the beginning of the season, playing Claudius. And he was supposed to bookend the season playing André in The Father that spring of 2020. In fact, we were set to begin rehearsals on Sunday, March 16th, 2020, the day the United States shut down. American audiences may now think of that film with Anthony Hopkins as the version of that story. But in fact, prior to the screen, the play The Father was translated into multiple languages, and it garnered Best Actor awards in many countries, including France, England, Ireland, America, South Africa, and Japan. We came to that script because a number of years earlier, a small group of us had just gathered on my porch one Saturday afternoon for a reading of scenes from plays that were under consideration for production at Theater B. And when we came to The Father, Doug's reading was so mesmerizing. Just sitting there on the porch, photocopies in our hands, the air changed. The outside world fell away as he held us in rapt attention. We forgot that we had intended only to read scenes. We wanted to read the whole play, but no one had brought the entire script. But it was clear to us in that moment that Doug was to play that role at Theater B. And we would, in fact, structure a season around that script. As soon as Doug was available, we would do it. With Doug in that plum leading role. And we were still waiting. When I last spoke to Doug, he was feeling hopeful. And he was acknowledging that the role would be challenging because it's a lot of memorization. It's an incredibly involved script. And because it's about dementia, it's repetitive in that way that is very difficult to memorize and keep track of exactly where you are in the story. It's intended to be that way. And prior to his treatment, he felt like he would be sharp enough, and he was still practicing, so he was indeed sharp enough. And so when I talked to him and I said, "We're waiting, and we will wait as long as it takes for you to be well and for you to feel confident that you can do this role justice the way you thought you could in 2017, 2018, 2019. We may still wait. It's such a beautiful script, and we'd love to bring it to this community. But it's hard to imagine it without him in that role. I am eternally grateful that the last time he was on our stage, it was not playing a man in decline. It was not playing a man with dementia who is struggling and losing his relationships along the way. The last time he was on our stage, he played a king. And that was fitting. Good night, sweet prince. And flights of angels sing thee to that rest.
That was executive director of Theater B, Carrie Winterstein, longtime friend of the late Doug Hamilton, who died Friday at age 72 following complications of acute myeloid leukemia. Now, to Carrie, he was an acting colleague. To me, he was a teacher and a mentor. To you, our dear listeners, of course, he was a consummate newsman. Joining me now is Director of Radio Bill Thomas on why Doug got this job. So, Bill.
Yes.
Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
Why did he get the job?
Well, it was pretty overwhelming. I'll have to say I knew of Doug actually from his brother many years ago. I've been involved in public radio for a long, long time. And so has Doug's brother. And I met him, I think at the time he was still working at Minnesota Public Radios before he became an independent consultant. And when I came to Fargo, he mentioned to me that his brother has you know, done a lot of stuff here. So I'd kind of heard about Doug even before I got here. And then so we had an opening host of this show. And we had a lot of very plausible candidates, actually, people who had experience in broadcasting in one sort or another, and were looking at them and, you know, kind of trying to figure out balancing different things. And Doug came in kind of late in the process, and it was just it kind of eliminated everybody else, you know.
Right.
I mean, he was so, so qualified. Mm. And you know, he made it clear he'd retired and he wanted to be doing this again.
Mm.
And my only worry was that he came in with such a strong background and this background in commercial broadcast news that he would be set with a different kind of a tone or you know, a different mm-hmm. spirit.
Sort of just the presenter.
Yeah.
Versus the kind of listening, active listening that's public
yeah.
radio.
Okay. Well, and just stylistic things and mm-hmm. stuff. But I knew he had this family public radio connection, and he'd actually worked previously somewhat in public radio a long time ago. And so it didn't seem like really that big a worry that he was going to come in and just sound really different than the context. And, of course, he's masterful at many things, and including calibrating his vocal performance to appropriate parameters for whatever situation he's in.
Yeah. Well, we got so many hundreds of comments on the Facebook page, but a lot of them talk about his voice. In fact, we got a call just this morning from a listener who loves Doug's voice, that he would chuckle sometimes yeah. when he was talking, and this sense that he always had a homey kind of quality. And I've done 4 or 5 interviews already on Doug, and we are airing a tribute show coming up on August 26th. That is the day of his memorial service. And it's been astonishing to me how many people have said something like homey or down to earth or just a shocking lack of ego, even.
Well, I think that's part of the skill of doing a good job, is that he realized, as the best broadcasters do, that it's not about you. You know, it's not about the interviewer. It's about the person you're interviewing, or the people you're talking about, or the people you're talking to. And, you know, Doug's acting experience, I think, really came in here because he, of course, as I'm sure you've talked about elsewhere, is a wonderful actor mm-hmm. and very, very skilled and controlled as an actor. And that means sometimes people think of acting as like phoniness, but it really, for him, was the ability to work with the situation. So if he was interviewing a United States senator, if he was interviewing a representative of the Federal Reserve Bank, or if he was interviewing a farm worker or a young person talking about something in school, he would be appropriate to that interview and, yeah, and work with it.
An ability to relate.
Yeah, yeah. And it's I think a lot of people have noted, I know talking to some people who have observed his performance over the years was how prepared he was, how he always came in and they were talking about, you know, he knew what he was talking about. So if it was a story about national forests or is a story about energy policy or is a story about some community activity, he always knew what was needed to ask the good questions and bring out the good information and you know, occasionally challenge things a little too, though he was never a flamboyant in-your-face challenger. Mm. But he was also very prepared, I think, in knowing the tone and the way to address whatever interview situation he was in. Mm. So it wasn't just knowing the facts, but it was knowing how, you know, what's the way that's going to work well for this to communicate with people so that they learn something from it.
Right. Well, and that skill set of being able to challenge without starting an argument, and particularly you think growing up in the Midwest like Doug did, you know, you don't interrupt, you don't, you know, criticize, that kind of thing. But very much, like you said, it wasn't the style of just like yelling at someone or even disagreeing, but just making sure that there is a level of questioning that forces that person to open up more and to have to defend how they got there. How rare of a skill set is that?
Well, it's rare to see it develop to the point. I mean, I think it's a skill set that all interviewers have to have if they're going to get anywhere to some degree. But Doug, I think, developed it to an extraordinary degree. And, you know, perhaps it was his varied background that helped. You know, I wasn't around when he was a TV anchor to hear him. So I don't know how he did in that work. But I know that when he came to work here at Prairie Public, all the different parts of his background really seemed to come together to just, you know, this seemed like a perfect job for him. But, you know, maybe that was part of, again, his ability to know, you know, to find out what needed to be done and do it. But I think he was always my impression from talking to him separate from the job and seeing his Facebook posts and stuff like that is he just had an avid interest in the world and everything from international affairs down to what's going on locally and everything in between.
Yeah, he reminds me of, you know, when you watch Michael Phelps swim against other people who are also Olympians, and then Michael Phelps was just head and shoulders. In fact, I was also applying at the time to be host of what was then called Hear It Now. Now, of course, it's called Main Street. And I remember hearing that Doug threw his hat in the ring and I was like, well, I'm out. There's no way I'm gonna get this job now. But to that end, what you ended up doing was this sort of creative solution. I'm working some magic tricks with the budget. At the time, I was I was fully employed at Prairie Public, but in a different department. And as you mentioned, Doug was already retired, and so he didn't necessarily need the full-time job. And so to put us together, was that a hard sell to Doug to say, we want you to split this show with someone nobody's ever heard of?
Well, some people had heard of you, but
my mom.
I'm just trying to recall. No, it wasn't a hard sell. I'm trying to recall how we talked about it, I think he actually found it intriguing.
Okay.
So, and he is someone who's been helpful to other people in the field, I think. And did you find that with him?
Yeah. Yeah. To me, it was not a teacher in sort of the standard, I'm a lecturer and I'm going to go over these notes with you and here's why I think you should do this differently. And there's definitely a value in that. In fact, I'll credit our longtime producer, Skip Wood, of always working these scripts with me and, you know, playing around with words and with voicing and very hands-on in teaching. And then Doug's sort of approach was just kind of the leading by example of the always being prepared, of the having read the book and previous to that, six other books on that topic, just because he was always interested. And as much as I don't think that you can teach curiosity or even personal drive, it really can't be understated to live it day in and day out. In fact, I remember there was one rare day where he had, I don't know what happened, but he had forgotten about an interview. And I called him like 5 minutes, like, hey, are you coming for this interview? And he had totally forgotten about it. And he walked in and you would never have known because he was so well versed on the topic anyway, just by virtue of being deeply read. So for me, it was very much a kind of a teacher of just leading by example.
Yeah. Well, it was a great example because I think he was always oriented in doing the work here in trying to help people understand the world better by elucidating different subjects and different people, that his goal was better understanding out there, and that he worked toward that in many different ways. And, of course, he, as an actor, he was in many theater productions where he worked toward that in an artistic kind of way. But, you know, here it was straight ahead, like, let's find out more. Let's understand this better. Let's really understand this better. And I think the fact that he had a wide-ranging knowledge and that curiosity about so many things helped him understand stuff better, so then he could help us listening to these interviews to understand better what's going on with this policy or this event or this story.
And for that, we will always be thankful. The late Doug Hamilton, longtime host of Main Street, died Friday, August 5th, at age 72 of complications of acute myeloid leukemia. There will be a memorial service at 11 a.m. on Friday, August 26th, at the Hanson Theater at Minnesota State University, Moorhead. That day on Main Street, we will be airing a special tribute in his honor. We'll have more Main Street after this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. B&I Coal has commissioned a new drag line at the Center Mine.
This is B&I's fourth drag line.
Mike Hager is B&I's general manager. The drag line was purchased from Mississippi for $31 million. Pat Cutshall is B&I's vice president and the treasurer of B&I's parent company, Elite Energy. He says Elite owns wind power facilities as well as a high-voltage direct current power line.
We believe that all types of energy are important, and for different reasons. They all have their place. Obviously, we invested $31 million in being the treasurer of the company. We don't do that lightly, and we use it and look into the future of what that means.
The Center Mine supplies lignite to the Milton R. Young Power Station. That's where the carbon capture project, dubbed Project Tundra, is being developed. August is National Immunization Awareness Month, and Fargo Cass Public Health is observing it by offering two back-to-school vaccine clinics. Suzanne Schaefer is director of nursing. She says children, teens, and young adults are typically required to receive basic immunizations before attending school, and these clinics offer much-needed access to these vaccines. She says vaccination rates among students in North Dakota fell about a percentage point in the last couple of years, But Schaefer says vaccinations remain one of the most important preventative tools in public health.
The purpose of being vaccinated is to really just help our immune systems develop and strengthen so that they can fight off something if they were to get exposed at a later date. And so, you know, the vaccines just kind of give you a tiny fraction of maybe there's live vaccines or there's, you know, vaccines also that are inactivated, but they give you kind of a little bit of a fraction of the germ that causes your immune system to go into a working mode so that if they were exposed at a later time, they'd be ready to fight it off.
Fargo Cass Public Health is offering two vaccination clinics in Fargo on August 17th and 18th from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. Schaefer says pre-registration is available but not required. All children and teen vaccinations will be offered. And the first contestant to win the title of Miss America from North Dakota has announced she's running for North Dakota's lone U.S. House seat as an independent. Kara Mund interned for Senator John Hoeven in 2016, and she graduated from Harvard Law School earlier this year. She was named Miss America in 2018. The 28-year-old Bismarck native says she wants to be North Dakota's first female in the U.S. House. To be placed on the November general election ballot, Mund needs the signatures of 1,000 qualified North Dakota electors. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and the 23 Native nations that share that same geography. Learn more at bushfoundation.org.
You know that annoying voice in your head that just won't leave you alone? There's a name for it.
Chatter is a term I use to refer to getting stuck in a negative thought loop or harping on some misdeed or grievance or concern over and over and over again.
Learning how to tame our chatter this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
That's tonight at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and on a hot August day, it's nice to kick off your shoes, pour yourself a glass of water? Okay, maybe a beer, and dive into a book. We are visiting now with the author Brian Freeman, who has written dozens of thriller novels, including the most recent in the Jason Bourne series. He has also written The Deep, Deep Snow, Spilled Blood, and Thief River Falls. He joins me now to talk about his latest book, due out tomorrow, I Remember You, A Terrifying Look at False Memories. Brian, thanks so much for joining us today, and welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you. You know, I always love summer releases, because if you're getting a little hot out there on the beach, my books will give you that little chill to cool you down.
Yes, it is a chilling sense to this book. I definitely shuddered a couple times in just thinking about, oh, could this happen? So I'm going to let you describe the book, because I just want to tell everybody everything, and I would give it away.
Well, there's lots of twists and turns here to keep you turning the pages, and the basic premise of the novel is that this young woman named Hallie Evers actually dies in the first chapter during a rooftop party, and then she wakes up the next day having been revived in the hospital, and yet she can't remember what really happened, and in her head she has all these strange dark memories of places that she knows she's never been and people that she's never met. It's almost like someone else's memories may be inside her head. So that's the premise that starts off I Remember You.
Yeah, you really have a thing for memory. I mean, people, I think, famously, even if you haven't read the Bourne novels, you know that the spy Jason Bourne is found without having any idea who he is, and then all these weird, terrible, life-threatening things happen to him, and he has to reconstruct his life, and then now this is happening again with Hallie. What do you think it is about this idea of memory and personhood that is so compelling to a thriller novelist?
Yeah, that seems to be one of my themes, doesn't it? But all the way back in 2017, I wrote a book called The Nightbird about someone that was implanting memories into someone. And maybe that was what got me hooked up with the Bourne folks, because they could see I love dealing with memory as a theme. You know, I think it's just it has so much resonance for people, because you never really know whether you can trust your memories. And it's so easy for your memories of the past to become distorted that it just sort of fits naturally with the thriller world, where you're never quite sure what's real and what's not. Mm.
Well, I personally have been in the middle of telling a story and in my head gone, wait a second, that did not happen to me. I just remembered somebody else so vividly telling this story that I thought for a minute that it was my own story.
It's easy to do. And in fact, I remember when I was researching The Nightbird, I was reading a psychologist that dealt with memory. And she said that memories are kind of like clay. You take them out off the shelf and you mold them and shape them. And by the time you put them back in your head, they're just a little bit different from the way they started.
Yeah, well, that has all the makings of a good suspense novel. What made you want to center so much of this book around women? The main characters are women in this book.
Yeah, that's right. And that's actually been true of several of my most recent books. The Deep, Deep Snow and the Ursulina are both told in a female first person voice. And that's true of I Remember You as well. You know, for me, it really is about the nature of the character and the nature of the heroine. And it when I'm writing in the first person, it's not so much a question of the gender, whether it's male or female. It's a question of who that person is and how they connect with me as a writer. And sometimes you feel like the hero is resisting you a little bit, like they sort of have to have trust in you to tell their story. And other times the heroes and I just kind of click from the get-go. And I will say that was true of Hallie. Hallie seemed to really want to tell her story, and so when I came to her and said, would you let me do that, she said absolutely, and the novel just kind of poured out.
Did you have to make an offering of some sort? You know, you just used an interesting phrase when talking about character development, who that person is, and a book that deals with this idea of memories and implanted memories and false memories really calls into question this idea of what makes someone an individual and a person. And I'm thinking, and I don't want to force this on you because the book was written clearly before this Supreme Court decision came out, but as the country is dealing with Dobbs v. the Jackson Women's Health ruling and what that means for Roe v. Wade and this national discussion on personhood and who and what is a person, and then you have this book where there are memories that you're not really sure if these are actually my memories, and there's this kind of existential philosophical thread throughout the book of what makes someone an individual.
Yeah, that makes for such an interesting theme, and it also even kind of goes a little further into the question of what does it mean to be alive, because if you can preserve someone's memories after they're dead, and if those memories could actually live on in someone else, well, what does that mean in terms of who we are as people? So the kinds of things that the technology that I'm talking about and I Remember You, these are all things that are being explored and researched and experimented with in real venues. And obviously I'm taking it to a pretty dramatic extreme, but there's nothing in there that is not going to be rolling down the technology pike in a few years.
Okay, well, now that just gives me the chills again all over. I'm glad we're recording on an 85-degree day. Well, yeah, let's talk about some of the medicine that you are talking about in this book. And again, it's called I Remember You. We're visiting with the author, Brian Freeman. It deals with some medical researchers who are working to cure Alzheimer's. And so there is this idea of recording someone's memories and storing them. In the real world, sparked this idea that there is this ability out there to store memories and maybe replace them in the event of something like dementia or Alzheimer's.
Yeah. You know, well, it kind of started back when I was working on the Nightbird and I was dealing with the idea of people's memories being erased because there's this perception in psychology that with trauma patients, for example, maybe one of the options for treatment is to actually erase the memory of the traumatic incident. And can that, you know, help people deal with it? And I started kind of thinking about the other side of it. Well, if you could erase someone's memories, could you actually sort of transplant someone's memories? And when you think about the idea of Alzheimer's and memories being erased, I was sort of thinking about, you know, backing up my computer hard drive and saying, well, that's interesting. If you could back up a hard drive and then replace the data later on, could you do the same thing with someone's memories? Could you actually, you know, sort of make a backup drive of their memories? And if those memories vanish, could you end up, you know, replacing them and restoring them just the way you would data on your computer? And so I started looking into this, and I was amazed at the kind of research that's being done out there. There's a reference to the fact that there was a Russian experiment a couple of years ago where they had people in a lab thinking, looking at photographs on the image, and therefore thinking about those images. And they were trying to recreate what the person was seeing based on just their brain waves. And it was scary just how far that can go. And so I don't think this is too far down the road of science fiction. There's a lot of possibilities in this research for good or for bad.
Yeah, it makes me think you should send some copies to lawmakers and legislators, and you know you're going to have to get in on the ground floor of these laws here, because what you do with somebody's memories and somebody's essential self, if you come down to that idea.
Yeah, because it's one thing if you restore those memories into the person that had them, but what if you restored them into someone else?
Yeah, or manipulate them. We are visiting today with author Brian Freeman about his new book, I Remember You. And Brian, any mystery suspense novel has a big plot twist, and certainly there is that in this book. Did you know this ending when you started this book, or was it a plot twist for you too?
You know, usually I kind of know the backstory of the book before I start. I know the secrets, who did what to whom and why. But how I actually tell the story, that can evolve a lot as I'm putting the words on the page. So I usually kind of scope out the backstory and I do kind of a rough outline, like a roadmap to show me where I'm going. But then as I'm actually writing the book, it can change a lot as I actually unfold those secrets to the reader, because I like to be able to massage the suspense as I'm going, and I can kind of try to put myself in the head of the reader and figure where they are in terms of the drama, so that I can always kind of keep you on the edge of the seat as you go forward.
Yeah, I just think it's so fascinating to be able to be in the head of the reader, and then to be able to be in the head of, you know, the protagonist, the antagonist in the novel, and then, you know, you yourself are just, you know, being in your head doing regular Brian Freeman things.
Well, my wife always says she sleeps with one eye open. So.
Well, it was a book for me where I did not see that plot twist coming. I mean, I knew to expect a plot twist, but I didn't guess this ending. But going back, rethinking of how you built this story, you know, as always, the clues were there. And I'm thinking about this idea of when you are constructing the novel and dropping a little clue about, you know, the way somebody moves their hair or what shoes they wear or their clothing or where they decide to live or how they order off of a menu, that when you are reading it, it just sounds like, okay, it helps you to visualize that person. And then by the time you get to the end, you're like, ah, I missed it.
Well, that's exactly right. It's those little details that mean so much. And I've joked with my readers in the past that if you come across one of those somewhat long paragraphs and there's a lot of detail in there and you're thinking, oh, well, you know, I can probably skip that. Well, there's probably a clue hidden somewhere in the middle there.
Yeah. Do you ever kind of have to rehash those sections of the book where you're like, nope, that's too obvious. I got to get rid of, you know, this part, even the change in the name, for example.
Yeah, that's always something I'm kind of going back and forth to try to try to anticipate that that game with the reader and make sure I'm staying one step ahead of them.
Yeah. Do you read suspense thriller novels yourself?
You know, I used to. I used to be a huge mystery and suspense reader, and probably the only downside of you know breaking through as a writer 20 years ago was that I found I couldn't really read my own genre anymore. You know, when you write suspense all day long, curling up with somebody else's suspense novel at the end of the day, it kind of feels like work. It becomes more market research than entertainment. So these days I mostly read nonfiction, history, biographies, memoirs, things like that.
I was hoping you were going to say juicy, salacious romance novels.
Maybe I'll try that next.
That'll be the next in the Jason Bourne series. And speaking of the Bourne novels, you had another one just come out.
Yeah, that's right. The Bourne Sacrifice, my third Jason Bourne novel. There was The Bourne Evolution 2 years ago and then the Bourne Treachery last year and now The Bourne Sacrifice. And it's been so much fun writing the Bourne novels. And I love getting the feedback from readers who have been, you know, Robert Ludlum fans for so long and telling me that it's kind of like having Robert Ludlum back reading these new Bourne novels. So that makes me feel great.
You know, in talking about going back to the plot twist in this book, you said you usually have an idea of what's going to happen. And then the subtleties change as you are plotting out books in a series. Do you plot out 2-3 books in advance or just the one book at a time?
No, I usually do them one at a time. For example, I've got my Jonathan Stride series set in Duluth, and I actually have a new Stride novel coming out November 1st, The Zero Night. Anytime I'm dealing with a series book, whether it's Stride, whether it's Bourne, the first thing I'm doing is thinking not so much about the plot, but about the characters. I'm thinking about where the characters are in their lives and kind of what the natural next steps are for them. And then I usually build the plot around that so that the plot ends up kind of feeding into that sort of essence of the characters. So that therefore, as you're reading the book, it's also advancing the story of the characters with each novel. So I don't want to get too far ahead of myself in a series.
Yeah. You've already in the course of this conversation mentioned 3 books just this year coming out. So what, you don't sleep?
And the really scary thing is this is 3 books on top of the Ursulina, which actually came out February 1st.
That's so right. I've already had you on the show this year.
Yeah, exactly. Sleep has been kind of an optional extra the last couple of years. And I admit this year I'm only on track to be writing 2 novels. I feel like I'm slacking off a bit.
Are you just like too scared to sleep because you're writing terrible, scary things? Not terrible, but terrifying, scary things all day?
Yeah, every now and then you wake up at 3 in the morning and you're like, what am I doing?
Well, emerging from COVID as an author, you know, so many people didn't get to go on the face-to-face book tours, but maybe they enjoyed getting to reach a larger audience because they could do it over Zoom. What has been Brian Freeman's experience?
Yeah, that really has been such an amazing change over the past couple of years. I think it was 20 library events scheduled in spring of 2020, and of course they all got canceled. Wow. And just last month, I started in doing library programs again, and that was the first time I'd done them since winter of 2020. Zoom has been great. It's been an opportunity to stay in touch with readers, and really an opportunity to reach out to readers, you know, around the country and around the world who are in places that I otherwise probably never would really have a chance to do book events. But at the same time, I just love being, back in libraries and bookstores where I can talk to the readers face to face. I mean, there's just no substitute for that.
Yeah. Author Brian Freeman is out with a new book. It's called I Remember You. It is out August 9th. You can find out more at bfreemanbooks.com. He is also the author of about 24. I feel like by the time this conversation airs, it's going to be 3 or 4 dozen other books, including The Deep, Deep Snow, The Ursulina, Thief River Falls, out with the latest Bourne book, The Bourne Sacrifice, this summer as well. Brian, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
We'll have more Main Street in a moment.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
Hey, learners, it's easy to find a gym to keep your body healthy, but what about your brain? Humanities North Dakota creates classes and events that are like group fitness for your mind. And since 90% of their programming is offered online, you can keep learning and strengthening those mental muscles from wherever life takes you. You can join in the exercise of ideas and turn your gray matter into what matters. Just go to humanitiesnd.org to learn more.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and there are a number of rodents in that sort of nut-gathering phase of the year, getting ready for winter, from a chipmunk to a squirrel, or as we learn about in this week's Natural North Dakota essay from biologist Chuck Lura, the pocket gopher.
Most everyone's familiar with pocket gophers. North Dakota's home to two species of pocket gophers, the plain pocket gopher, which is mainly found in the Red River Valley, and the northern pocket gopher, which is found mostly west of the Red River Valley. We seem to see those gopher mounds most everywhere, but seldom see the gophers. Pocket gophers are dark brown to grayish, about 8 inches long, have small eyes and ears, buck teeth, and long front claws for digging. The pocket is a reference to their fur-lined pockets on the outside of each cheek for carrying food. As most everyone knows, pocket gophers spend the vast majority of their time underground, tunneling through the soil and feeding on plant material. They feed on a variety of underground plant parts, such as roots, rhizomes, tubers, corms, bulbs, etc. They're considered generalist herbivores, but seem to prefer broadleaf plants, such as alfalfa, and avoid woody plants. One may on a rare occasion see a pocket gopher above ground. They're known to occasionally feed above ground very near the tunnel entrance, which allows for a quick escape if danger is detected. While tunneling, they may also pull above ground plant parts down into the tunnel. But the bulk of their diet comes from what they encounter through their tunneling activities. That's where things are getting interesting. We occasionally hear about beavers being compared to engineers. Well, pocket gophers have been recently compared to farmers. Based on recent research conducted by scientists at the University of Florida, it appears that at least the southeastern pocket gopher is tending or farming the underground plant parts they harvest to eat. The gopher's tunneling activities, for example, soil aeration, soil mixing, distribution of feces and urine in the tunnels, as well as the actual harvesting of plant materials, increases root growth and perhaps other below-ground plant parts. As you might be thinking, the increased new succulent and nutritious growth protrudes into the tunnel, which is then consumed. It looks like the pocket gophers are raising a fresh crop of roots. So as you look around at all those pocket gopher mounds this summer, considering that maybe, just maybe, those North Dakota pocket gophers are also doing a little root farming down there. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
I'm Kelly Corrigan. I'm wondering about grandparents, the arts, and magazines, and how these things come together to grow the army of kids who think deeply and strategically about our planet and how to make it a livable place for generations to come. Kelly Corrigan Wonders.
Kelly Corrigan Wonders. Listen Tuesday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for August 8th. Born in Springfield, Ohio in 1818, Charles Cavalier moved to Carmel, Illinois at the age of 17. After a few years, he pulled up stakes and headed west. He settled in Red Rock, Minnesota, 6 miles south of St. Paul, but soon relocated to St. Paul, where he opened a shop in 1845. He sold out in 1847 to start the town's first drugstore in partnership with a doctor. But he was a restless soul. In order to move on to other adventures, he sold his share of the drugstore to the doctor. Cavalier would become a prominent citizen, holding many government positions in Minnesota Territory. He was the first territorial librarian, and President Fillmore appointed him territorial customs collector. He served in that position for several years before moving to Pembina. He formed a partnership with Norman Kitson and engaged in a successful fur trade between Walhalla and Fort Garry in Canada. In 1851, Cavalier was one of three white men, along with Kitson and Joseph Rolette, living in what is now North Dakota. In an interview with a reporter, Cavalier remembered the early days when he hauled furs by the two-wheeled Red River carts. On one trip, their guide suddenly became concerned and told them to hurry in positioning their carts in a V formation. The group heard a distant rumble, and soon a herd of buffalo had descended upon them, veering around the temporary fort of ox carts. Cavalier said it took 2.5 days for the gigantic herd to pass by. Known as the father of Pembina, Cavalier was the town's first postmaster. When he retired, his son took over as postmaster. Cavalier was also one of the first county commissioners, the first county treasurer, and first probate judge. He served several terms as the mayor. He was a colleague of many well-known people, including Pierre Botteneau and Governor Alexander Ramsay. On this date in 1902, Charles Cavalier's obituary appeared in North Dakota newspapers. He had many honors and accomplishments, but perhaps the best was the way he was remembered, with the obituary noting that his friends and neighbors considered him an honest, upright, and charitable citizen. This Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Marie Offutt.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Whether you're a sustaining member, or you give annually, or you've made additional contributions to Prairie Public, we thank you. Your generous support invests directly in the programs and services you and your community enjoy and depend on. Thank you, Prairie Public members. We're humbled by your trust.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, we learn about the Artists on Main Street program and some money available for artists. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.